It's Christmas morning. Your parents are still fast asleep. Why won't they wake up? It's 4:15. You get out of bed, creep towards the curtains. Has it snowed? No, it hasn't. But who cares? Today's not about what's out there. It's about what's in here. Today, it's all about the toys.
Colourful animations of games and toys. The metal jacks of Ball and Jack, a marble rolling past, and cars on a Scalextric track. The computer game Pong, Lego bricks, and the pieces from a Monopoly game. A space hopper, Connect Four, a ball and cup game, Simon Says, and a Meccano. BBC, the toys that made Christmas.
Every year since Christmas began, way back in the early 1950s, the toys have been different, but the result has been exactly the same. There are toys you'll love forever and the ones you'll forget about in seconds. Toys you'll swap for football cards and the ones you'll defend with your life. This is the story of some of the best-loved toys of all time, and some of the worst, some of the strangest, and some that'll make you say, I had one of those. Yeah.
Dated footage of toy trucks, a wind-up bear, a doll in a box, a rocket being built, a train set, a puppet band, Scalextric, then a woman carrying a giant teddy.
Toys as a whole, they're just brilliant connections to the past. Just like a piece of music or a smell, the touch of your teddy takes you back through the decades.
Jenny and Phil Wonder, children of the 1950s.
Boys used to make little tanks out of wooden bobbins, edges on with a candle and an elastic band, and it would actually shoot matchsticks, along the floor and shoot matchsticks.
That elastic band became a catapult as well.
Yeah.
Greg Wallace, child of the 60s.
There was one toy I got, and I must have been about 3 or 4 years old, and it was a circus. A circus with a train to carry all the animals in. And it was so brightly coloured and big to me as a child. And it was kept at my grandmother's house because I'd go there regularly and I'd play with it every single time I went there. And I found it again, aged about 15, 16, and it seemed so small, but it really made me smile. It makes me smile. I actually want to cry now because it's all wrapped up, isn't it, with memories of my nan and my granddad. And yeah, that was a lovely present.
Peter Jim.
I have to say, one of the greatest magical moments of my Christmas was, I think I was aged, it was either 5 or 6, and I woke up and Father Christmas had been, and there was a brand new bike.
It was like seeing paradise or heaven. Shangri-La, Nirvana, there it was a grifter bike.
It's freedom. It's the first sense of freedom. It's like your own wheels. It is like having a car as an adult.
Early 80s, I think, was the highlights of my Christmas career. There was always some sort of bit of plastic tat that you were desperate for.
I had two My Little Ponies, and there was something just really special about them. They were very compact, they had names. I had a horse when I was little, so most of the things that I liked were connected with horses, so it tapped into something that I was really excited about.
I used to collect those Britain's farm horses. More precious to me then than life itself. And it also chimed with the fact that when I was aged between about 8 and 13, I actually wanted to be a horse. That was it. I did spend quite a lot of time as a horse. So I would go along the street as if I was simultaneously horse and rider, occasionally slapping my own leg to make me go a bit quicker. As I say, I had a very troubled childhood. But I'm very fond of them. I wouldn't part with them. And I'm happy to say I am no longer a horse.
Those sort of little plastic things, it's actually quite strange that how attached to those that you could be. I've still got, and it's in my handbag now, a Care Bear that I carry around with me that I've always, since I was a child, carried around with me. Shall I show you? There. Good luck, Bear.
Toys that you touch and you look at, the ones you remember, the ones that are locked away somewhere in this memory bank, and you can bring it back. When I see a Dinky, or when I see a Meccano set, it evokes those wonderful memories. I think they have a massive impression that they can leave the best toys.
This is from my day, actually. This is sooty. Sooty's very, very popular, but there's so many of them and they made a lot of them. He's going to be 40, 50 pounds, something like that. Really? Yes. OK, no, he says he's worth more.
Robert Webb's sitting in a red chair.
It's the first thing you do on Christmas Day, open your stocking, because you don't even have to get out of bed. The tradition of Christmas stockings goes back to Norse times, when children would fill their clogs with carrots and straw for Odin's horse, Sleipnir. Nowadays, things are a lot more sophisticated. Odin has become Father Christmas, and he gets sherry, mince pies, maybe a little brandy, a few chocolates, a tot of whiskey, slice of cake, maybe some grappa. Basically, he gets plastered. And Rudolph still gets a carrot. Cheers. Most important of all, the clog has become a giant sock into which you can stuff far more tat. Christmas stockings in the 1950s contained simple fare. Nuts, fruit, maybe a skipping rope, or if you were really lucky, it might have an actual car. You look a lot less mad if you do that with one of these in your hand. If you're a kid, full-size cars represent everything that is awful. Incarceration, tedium, and something your dad spends hours polishing when he should be building you a treehouse. But reduce the scale of the car by about 500 times, and it was brilliant. It didn't matter if it was an Aston Martin or a Volvo estate. It was small, shiny, and the perfect size to drive over your sister's face. Vroom!
Toy racing cars. Then two on the starting line of a toy racetrack. Don Warrington, child of the 1960s.
A car's a very beautiful machine. I mean, especially when you're a little boy. Sometimes you can get in them and they allow you to pretend to be anybody.
Sir Stirling Moss.
We had a bit of ground you could go on, which was sort of beaten earth, really. And we used to tow cars around on a string. The first contact I had with a toy car, I suppose.
With cars, well, first of all, you'll want to be men, and men drive cars. I don't know where we think that, women drive cars, but as a boy, you kind of think dads drive cars.
Anthony Worrell Thompson, child of the 50s.
I had masses and masses and masses of cars. Loved cars. Started with Matchbox, because they were cheapest. I think I got a little one every week as a sort of set of pocket money.
Lesney's, after the Second World War, hit on this thing, reducing a life-size car, taking out the elements and selling it for 1 in 6 or something. Pocket money price, you'd have to save up for 3 weeks in order to be able to buy your next Matchbox car, and you keep it in your pocket.
Lesney Products started as die casters. They were making commercial die castings for the electrical industry, so aerial sockets, pieces for record players and that sort of thing. But because of the way the tax laws worked in those days, if you had too much stock at the end of the year, you were taxed on it. So companies used to stop placing orders 3 months from their year end. So there was a commercial die caster thinking, what am I doing between October and December? I've got no orders. So there's Christmas. Let's make some toys. It started in 51 in the cellar of a disused pub in Edmonton. The reason why it was in the cellar was the only part that had a roof above it. The rest of it had just been blown up in the war. If you go look at the first Matchbox toys that were made, they were all commercial vehicles. They were toys that a child would see rebuilding London. So there was a road roller, there was a cement mixer, there was a dump truck. It's things they saw every day and they could identify with. It was really an idea of my father's partner, Jack. His daughter had come home from school and said, I've got to take something to school tomorrow, but it can only fit in my hand. He'd been playing around with the idea of making small cars, and he made a mould of one, so he gave it to her and said, there you are, it'll fit in your hand, take it to school.
You could stop these vehicles with your little finger. They're Matchbox cars, 2-inch replicas of their expensive big brothers, current models or vintage cars. Collectors as well as children buy these toys, so the designer has to make sure that all the details have that authentic touch.
I think with the Matchbox toys, it gave children a sense of ownership. It was small enough to be theirs. They were sold in the 1950s for 1 and sixpence, that's 7.5 pence. It was something that was within a pocket money price for virtually everybody. And so it was something that a child could go into a shop with the week's pocket money or the month's pocket money and buy a car. In the early 60s, they built their biggest factory in the UK, which was about 250,000 square feet of production space, employed just over 1,500 people, and at its top rate could produce something like 1 million toys per day.
Today, the entire miniature car industry in Britain turns out 500 million models a year. In fact, it's growing more rapidly than any other side of the world's toy production. And this company leads the world. Not surprisingly, they've just received their second Queen's Award to industry. Not bad for a firm that started in such a small way.
The Queen came to visit one year with Prince Philip. It was, I have to say, it was the cleanest I think my father had ever seen the factories. Everybody was dressed up to the nines for her visit, and she stayed about 3 hours walking around and went away with some toys for the boys. So everybody had a good day. My father lived and breathed Matchbox toys. He would always tell you that the best model they ever made was the London bus, because everybody knew what a London bus looked like. Whether they lived in London, New York, Sydney, or Moscow, they all knew that London buses were red. So as long as he had a London bus in the range, he was happy.
Andrew Smith, son of Leslie Smith, founder of Matchbox Toys. Now Alfie Bow, child of the 70s.
I think having a little toy car was one step towards driving one yourself. You could really sort of take it anywhere and do anything with it. It could jump over the sofa or whatever you wanted to do. So it was a real sort of toy that you could seriously control.
Black and white home footage of a child peddling a toy car in the garden.
I couldn't be a racing driver in a real car, but I could have a dinky and I could pretend I was a racing driver. This is a genuine dinky, Alfa Romeo, made in England, Meccano, number 232. Iconic of the time. I can be the driver. We used to race these down slopes, and by golly, there they go. In fact, this particular model will beat my grandson's Hot Wheels every single time. And it's still usable after 50 plus years.
A robot car.
When I was growing up, they were gimmicky cars. And so not only would you have, say, a car, but it was a car that turned into a submarine. It looks just like a normal car, doesn't it, obviously? And there were also missiles in the top. And you would do that. And what I remember about that primarily is my mum had cats. And one of the greatest things we'd do is I'd put missiles in there, little red missiles. And I would just go behind a cat. And I would just go like that. And it would fire one. They were really good. You could hit the cat at the back end and it would run off. And so, you know, what more could you want?
Okay.
Don Warrington's handed a box-shaped present. He pulls off the gold ribbon and carefully peels back the red paper. He unwraps the rest of it. A Scalextric set.
Well, 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 well. My dreams have come true. I had to wait all these years. And here it is.
Paddy O'Connell, child of the 70s.
Lots of children around me were getting Scalextrics, which I never had. It was a racing game. And you think of the great racing name, Stirling Moss. These cars, when they came up, were full of imaginative possibilities.
You've got figure of eights, and it goes through tunnels and chicanes and valleys over hills, all that kind of thing.
A complex racetrack.
It was great when you could control the car enough for it to just go around the track very gently, and yeah, you can sit there for hours and it'll just continue to go around. But the best thing about a Scalextrics was making it do what it wasn't designed to do. Basically, turning the track into a ramp to see how far you could fly your car and see how much you could knock off the shelf, you know, or get it into the birdcage.
I wanted to create a whole country, take a whole room and just turn it into one huge set. That's what I wanted.
Two real cars race along a track to the checkered flag.
Up until the 1960s, Christmas shopping was a tranquil delight. You walked to the high street, which was lightly dusted in snow, and bought a single present from the toy shop, usually a bicycle. This would then be delivered by a ruddy-cheeked lad on another bicycle, to whom you would throw a shiny penny. Job done. Another lad on another bicycle would bring a goose and a truckle of vole's hearts, and that was your Christmas shopping taken care of. Lovely. Now, Christmas shopping is officially designated by the UN as a form of war, albeit one that's exempt from the Geneva Convention. Like most other forms of modern warfare, it's mainly carried out via computers, situated hundreds of miles from the combat zone, which is a warehouse the size of Lincolnshire. In Lincolnshire.
Black and white footage of Father Christmas.
Now then, what do you want for Christmas?
A new bike and a pencil sharpener.
Chocolate train.
Yes, please. A sewing set.
Tell me, what is it you want?
A gun.
It's beginning to the busy streets of London with Christmas lights, then children staring in through shop windows, one with his face squashed against the glass.
Going to a toy shop was like a dream come true.
Is the holly that will be.
It was an incredible adventure.
There would be emporiums in the city centre of Manchester. We'd be taken to like three floors. It's like Aladdin's cave. It was like heaven. But you wouldn't expect to come away with something necessarily.
The idea of the child going wild with excitement with a massive list of things that they want really starts to take off in the mid to late 60s. By that stage, a new consumer revolution has really bit into British life. The kind of bold new era of the big, expensive toy is emerging.
I grew up in the purple patch for modern toys, which was the 1970s. It was the crossover, really. People were dumping all those hapless old pickup sticks, toy soldiers. In were coming the first kind of electronic games, sort of pneumatic games, racing games that you could pump up. All sorts of things were happening in the 70s.
I've seen this massive evolution towards saying, well, actually, this is a big market the business needs to go for, and I suspect that's been helped through the media, through the accessibility to those children. I wasn't sold to as a child in the same way that children are sold to now.
I can safely say, as a father of two myself, the amount of adverts for toys on TV during the kids' programming is horrendous. Every single advert, my eldest boy, Tommy, goes, can I have that? Can I have that? Can I have that? Can I have that? And we've given up trying to say, no, Tommy, no, you can't. So now we just go, yep, yep, yep.
Children are very aware that if they want it badly enough and they keep going on about it, then that is a very powerful tool to get the thing that they want.
Deborah Meaden.
But who cares about Christmas shopping? That's what the staff are for, mum, dad, grandparents. What counts is that everything is downstairs now, waiting for your attention.
Children look at their presents.
The humble tree has borne fruit and dropped its magnificent harvest of presents. Hey kids, look at that little lot. We all remember that feeling of staring at the vast heap of presents and thinking, two or three of those.
A girl gets a doll.
Dolls were invented so little girls could carry their baby brother or sister around without the screaming and the awkward visits from the social services when they dropped them. At first, they were innocent and charming, but then something happened. Dolls started to grow up. From babies to toddlers to children, soon they were older than the little girls who were playing with them. And when they hit puberty, all bets were off. They quickly developed a fashion sense, a love for accessories, boyfriends and cars. And who had to buy it for them? Well, you did, of course, to show you loved them. You do love your doll, don't you? Then why haven't you bought her a new bag, a new dog, a new boat, a new house?
Animated Barbie and Action Man. Dated film shows a man making a clay mould of a doll's head. Then in the factory, a woman adds hair to a proper doll's head, chucks it into a box along with many others. Another woman puts it under a stencil and sprays it, and the blue eyes are added and the hair brushed. Catherine Howell, Collections Manager, V&A Museum of Childhood.
Early dolls were made really as more as fashion items than as toys. They wouldn't have been particularly sort of play items, at least up until the 19th century. A lot of dolls were actually quite difficult to play with. They were quite delicate. You had to be careful with them. Got myself
a crying doll. A collection of different dolls.
This was my first real doll. It was very special. I can remember reaching down and feeling and thinking, oh, gosh, it's a doll. And when I opened it and its eyes opened and closed, that was wonderful. Because they were made of pottery, any bump or bang chipped a little piece off. This one's got a piece out of her head. So really, you treated them very gently. There was no swinging them round by their arms. Take a look at
her hair. It wasn't, of course, until the introduction of plastic that dolls just became more and more realistic.
Black and white film of a woman in a shop demonstrating a doll to a child by pulling a string in its back. Got myself a crying doll. Tears drop out of the doll's eyes.
Tiny Tears was sort of the first one that grabbed the public's imagination, really. I suppose the name as well, it was a very clever name.
Tiny Tears was a favourite. You know, her arms used to come off and clearly she used to wee everywhere because that was her great attraction. So once she had Tiny Tears, she had to be left in the bathroom, otherwise she'd just leak from limbs all over the place.
She cries again. Now elegant, well-dressed and smaller dolls.
The fashion dolls of the 1960s, of course, is something everybody knows about now. The best-known fashion doll, of course, is Barbie.
The main attraction, I suppose, if you can call it that, of having a teenage doll was that she did have a bust. She had a bosom of sorts, but she did. And, of course, you know, when you're 10 or 11, you want to look like everybody, you know, a young teenager yourself. And so it was a sort of aspirational thing, I think, really, to have a doll like that.
The dolls are always an extension of your own personality. They tap into something in little girls, particularly in boys as well, about that need to dress up and to customise yourself. Every girl
dreams. Cindy, launched in the UK in 1962. Of having a garden. Jerry Reynolds, CEO, Pedigree Group.
Cindy's whole world was skewed to what was happening with the girl next door, or maybe the aspirational girl next door. There were things like horses, ponies, stables, reflection in miniature of what is happening in the world outside.
We used to make a lot of things for her, little baths, whole room sets, that kind of thing. In fact, one of my first makes was a four-poster bed, which was a triumph of cereal boxes and frills.
I think she was special because you could invest some of your sort of grown-up emotion into her. She was like an older version of you. One year I got the Cindy house, which is a three-storey house. My parents had to install it and put this thing up. And apparently they were still putting it up at 1 o'clock in the morning when they had to ring for help. And I think they'd had a bit of wine by then as well, so it was a difficult task. But there was nothing more overjoying than seeing that wrapped up on Christmas Day.
Black and white film of women walking down the street in miniskirts and boots or heels.
There were a lot of other sort of British fashion dolls that came out sort of following Cindy. And one of these was Daisy.
Mary Quant, fashion designer.
I wanted to do a doll that was fashionable than the way my clothes were fashionable.
Film of young women modelling her mini dresses.
We had these very 11-inch dolls, like same size as Cindy. And all the clothes, and made all the clothes to go for it, which were much like our collection.
They pose on a set while the press take photos.
We would show the clothes to the press on real models, you know, the best top models, which we gave them hair so they looked like Daisy the doll, and the clothes were kind of full scale. And that was a wow. It was King's Road, absolutely, all over again, yeah.
Action Man, launched in the UK in 1966.
Boys wouldn't have said, oh, I'm playing with a doll, but, you know, it was a doll for boys.
Action Man was a soldier
He could, there was nothing girly about Action Man. He had guns.
Willie Naughton, child of the 70s.
Anybody who has as fond memories of Action Man as I do will remember the key thing to remember is, and they'll know what I'm doing, is that Action Man, you put your hand to the back of Action Man's head and just do that. You know, just a little button. You get his eagle eyes.
I didn't want anything too rugged to put my Action Man in. I wanted the amazing uniform from the Charge of the Light Brigade. So my Action Man was the only Action Man that had thigh boots.
Action Man on a horse in uniform.
My Action Man never played with other Action Men. You know, friends of mine came round, my Action Man was very aloof and snooty. But he looked sensational. By thunder, he looked good.
An Action Man flag, then the animated eagle eyes moving.
Toys have been around as long as children, who've been around nearly as long as adults. As soon as the first child spun a stick or threw a pebble at a saber-toothed tiger, toys were in the world. The very first top 10 lists in the year's most wanted toys included the hoop, the ball, the piece of wood, and the runaway bestseller for 700 years, the pig's bladder on a stick. In the years after World War II, rationing led to a national shortage of pig's bladders. As the shortage bit and the children of Britain turned instead to unexploded bombs as playthings, toy manufacturers were forced to come up with safer alternatives. For kids, the great advances in technology in the 20th century suddenly had a purpose. Toys.
Old black and white film of a boy pushing a tire along with a stick, others playing with a small football, and more riding a cart down a hill. Animated bears, moving wind-up toys, and a train set.
A toy, to me, is anything that a child plays with. You can't define it. It's all play, and they're all toys.
All children play with toys. It's just what you count as a toy, isn't it? A stick is a toy. A bit of mud in the backyard is a toy. You don't have to have money to be playing with toys. In some ways, the simpler stuff's great because it just helps you develop your imagination more.
Would you like some cake?
Yes.
I guess the history of toys is the history of the human race in small form, and it's the history of industrialization and consumerism and gender history, and it is social history in a tiny nutshell. You can see, for example, when Princess Victoria was growing up in a very controlled, princess-like environment, she didn't get to have much fun. But one of the fun things that she did get to do was to dress up all of her little peg dollies with her governess. She had about 150 of them. She made their own little costumes for them, and she invented these crazy backstories. They all had scandalous lives. They were duchesses, they were having lovers, they were going off and doing this, that, and the other. And it's great that she had something outside her immediate environment to engage her imagination.
Playing with toys is role play, really. I mean, playing with other children with your toys. Absolutely. You're communicating, you're learning how to get on together. You make real life situations within a play setup.
It's how we work out the world, how we understand the world, and everybody's got to play.
A girl puts her dolls to bed.
Your toys and you had an equal relationship. So you, when you were playing with them and when you were playing with other people, because my sister and I were passionate about playing with the small dolls together, you kind of invented a world. And it was a world that you understood because you'd made it yourself, but also a world that was, although there was jeopardy in it, you know, the doll that survives the fall from the windowsill, it's still jeopardy that you've imposed. So I suppose that the psychological thing is that you are creating order.
Children play shop.
I think that toys can give you an entirely different and an utterly controllable narrative. It's a trigger or a key to enter into a mysterious world.
I think the kind of things that a child plays with and continues to play with very often influence their careers and what they do and what they choose to do.
It's bound to make a big difference, isn't it, what you play with when you're a kid? I mean, or perhaps you could say which comes first. Is it that you're that sort of person, so those are the toys you enjoy? Or is it that you enjoy those toys and it makes you into a different person? I don't know. But there's no doubt about it. Almost everything I really remember enjoying playing with a kid has got some sort of little echo in my later life.
There was one toy that changed my life, and it wasn't mine, it was my sister's. Somebody bought my sister a little record player, and it was a portable. This was quite a desirable toy, a portable record player, where you put the vinyl on and you put the needle on the record, and it goes round like it should. And I think it was battery operated, and it would play tunes out of a very bad speaker system, but we could hear it. And she got that, I remember, one Christmas, and I got the Jackson 5's Greatest Hits. So it was a marriage made in heaven. Me and my sister became very close for about a year. I put the album on her record player, and we danced to it. The only record we had for about a year, and we played it every day. And I fell so much in love with the Jackson 5 that I just fell into music massively, and I started getting obsessed and buying records with my dinner money, my bus fare, and I still have thousands of records to this day, and mainly because of that toy.
Rolling Marbles.
In the 50s, the universe was still a place of mystery and wonder. Space was still the final frontier, not a CGI backdrop. No one looked up at the stars and thought, actually, that looked a lot better on Battlestar Galactica. Space represented the outer limits of the human imagination, and wherever the human imagination went, toys soon followed.
An animation of TIE fighters swooping towards the Death Star. Archive black and white footage of the moon.
July 1st marks the beginning of one of the great scientific adventures of our time. This is
ground control. Newsreel of astronauts in space, JFK and cosmonauts preparing for a mission.
3, 2, 1, 0, all engine running.
The 60s, it was all about the space race.
Toys are actually very important in reflecting what goes on in real life.
The moon landing.
I'm at the foot of the ladder. I'm going to step off the land now. That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
We were all obsessed as kids. You know, man had walked on the moon, and all our toys kind of reflected all that paraphernalia. My best Christmas morning was, there was a toy called the Johnny Astro. It was like a balloon that attached to legs. It was like a joystick that moved this articulated fan. You had a throttle there to get the power, and you could actually ride the balloon on this jet of air and steer it around the room. It was brilliant. I remember one store, I just got it, and the blooming budgie took it down. It was like Black Hawk Down. That was me, Johnny Astro.
People were hooked into this idea of other worlds. It took over people's imagination, and the toy manufacturers were very quick to spot this and created all sorts of weird and wonderful, you know, science fiction characters.
I remember seeing the big package and thinking, oh my God, is that the Millennium Falcon? Is it the Millennium Falcon? Please let it be the Millennium Falcon. And you wrap, and even when you start to see a bit of a picture of it on it, you think, but what if I'm wrong? What if it's a Millennium Falcon duvet set? Or what if it's Millennium Falcon pyjamas? I will never forgive her, but I've got a smile. And you rip up a bit more and you think, it looks really like it is. And when you realise it is, I thought I'd die and go into heaven when I got the Millennium Falcon.
Star Wars toys being manufactured.
The unlikely centre of every little boy's space-age universe is the Palatoy factory at Coalville in Leicestershire. Here, the women are riveted to one of the busiest production lines in the trade. The staff here has just about doubled to meet the demand.
A whole range of Star Wars toys in a shop.
There were always toys, action men, and we all had action men. But suddenly you go and see something at the cinema, and then there would be the toy that went with it. You would have to have it.
I think the Star Wars phenomenon is the most explosive thing that's happened in the last century. Brilliant, absolutely brilliant. The whole idea of these really frightening faces, if you can call them faces, and they're all very aggressive. This is a big version. They have different sizes. This would have been probably quite an expensive version. With the original box for this one, it's very nice to have it. They make good money, you know. We're talking about hundreds, but they've got to have the original boxes. Not quite as chewed as this one.
All the boys would have the figures, but you were really considered, you know, better if you had one of the ships. This is the toy. It's the Star Wars Millennium Falcon. It makes noises. You can take the back off. They could play their space chess. I do still very much love this toy, and am a little bit nervous about giving it to my two kids, but I have promised when I get home that I am giving this to the boys. So, goodbye. Goodbye, old girl.
All over the universe, wars were erupting. Well, they weren't. We'd made them up, because there wasn't enough war here on Earth. Well, there was, but it wasn't fun war. Well, that didn't worry the toy industry, though. While feminists were fretting about the effect Barbie and her friends were having on little girls, no one was watching the boys. Over in the blue corner, things were going absolutely haywire.
I loved guns. Guns, for me, were fab. I had every sort of gun. I was a one-boy armory.
We spent a lot of time playing war games. We'd have our stick guns and we'd be crawling through the bushes and essentially killing each other. War and play, they're all part of culture, they're all part of life. And as much as we like to think that society will be eternally peaceful, there will always be some kind of disruption. And this is often going to be reflected in toys and in how children relate.
We used to have gunfights, which were good. We'd try and work out who was the fastest on the draw. You'd meet your friends in the park and we'd count to three and then you'd reach for your revolver. And used to pretend to have a horse, really, which was quite good. Sometimes you just had a stick or whatever it was and you'd gallop along. I suppose it looked rather strange.
Army toys being made in a factory.
Every country somehow has to reproduce its armies. What happened in Germany once Hitler came to power was that a lot of German toy companies had to produce figures of the entire Third Reich. They are quite chilling when you see miniature Stalins and miniature Hitlers. But here, companies like Britain's were doing the same. And kids were playing it out because it was part of their environment at the time. If you talk to people born during the war, they quite often played on bomb sites. And there can be nothing more exciting than playing on a bomb site.
You improvise in those days. You going out, running around, pretending you were being chased by Japanese soldiers or Germans or whatever. It was 10 years after the war, so it was very much still in memory.
World War II was still very, very fresh in people's minds. We always talk about going up to play on the bommy, and it was this area of land where a landmine had dropped at the top of the street, where incendiaries had dropped, you know, some people's front doors hadn't been repaired, but it basically was a bomb buildings. So that was part of play.
Those kids who played on those bomb sites, that was the beginning of the whole adventure playground movement. That's where that idea came from, because playgrounds were very prescriptive. But if you could actually transpose in a safe environment that sense of adventure, of going into the unexplored and away from the adults, that was amazing.
Toy robots.
It's 11 o'clock and everyone is in the kitchen. It's Christmas. Why are they in there? Are they nuts? Yes, they are. They're making Christmas dinner. They're swearing and drinking and crying. It's like a Mike Lee film with bread sauce. I'd get out before you get dragged into it. You see that present? The ball-shaped one. It's a ball. Grab it and run.
Sabutio figures.
We used to use a tennis ball to play football.
replica footballs weren't really available. It would be something special to get what we would call a casey, which was like a leather football with a bladder inside and some stitching. And if you headed that, whew, would knock your head back, particularly if it was wet.
Historically, the key toys have been a ball, something that spins, something to wrap up and cuddle, something on wheels to pull. Different things come in, new materials and everything, but a ball is still a ball, and something so simple in design, which has such huge ramifications for catching, for kicking, and supports a huge industry, the football industry. Where would it be without the ball?
A foosball table, a magnetic football game, and Sabutio.
Here we are at the Sabutio Stadium. Here come the teams. It's England versus Brazil. England kick off. A beautiful ball, and there's a quick breakaway. Oh, good play. England shoot. What a save, and it's a corner.
Sabutio was the traditional football game.
So it's 1-0 to England.
The pitch, from what I remember, was cloth. The players were like little weebles, the little weighted, little round things. And the player would be on this, and so it would wobble, but it wouldn't quite fall down. You get the goal, you can even get a crowd on the really special Sabutio set, and you really feel, wow. You line your teams up and you get a ball, and basically you flick the base of the player, and it kicks the ball.
It was just post-war. There was actually a game on the market called New Footy. My father saw this and he suddenly had an idea that he could improve on it. He put an advert in a boys' magazine at the time. It was called Boys Own Magazine. He went away. I think he was in America on holiday. He got a telegram from his mum saying, I've had loads and loads of replies to this advert and people are actually sending in their postal orders. And he said, you know, we've got a bit of a problem. People are sending in their money wanting a game and there's no game to go out. So it was all hands to the pump to get a basic game up and running. And as it was post-war, he had a problem with getting the actual playing pitch. So what he did to get around that, he actually enclosed a piece of chalk in the game. And there were lots of old army blankets lying around. People had them at home. And with instructions in the first sets, just say, mark out, here's a piece of chalk, mark out your own pitch on an old army blanket. And that's really how it started.
Sabutio was the ultimate game you wanted as a boy. I remember getting our first set. The little men, it was brilliant. I remember them all in their package with the goalie with the long green thing. And I had a Chelsea one and my brother got the Spurs one.
I think the magic of it was that little boys, or not so, you know, even the dads used to play. I think it's being able to recreate real football matches in miniature.
We're human. We build. We can't help ourselves. Ever since Neanderthal man took two bits of wood and joined them together with dried animal gut, we've made things with no discernible purpose. For some, this instinct led to such wonders as the pyramids, Stonehenge, the ships that conquered the seas, the cities that reached for the skies. Anyway, good luck to them. For the rest of us, it meant a wonky crane with the rope all twisted, or a Wellington bomber with one of the engines glued on back to front. Construction toys are there to make our inner idiot feel like a Nobel Prize-winning engineer.
A Meccano Christmas tree.
I believe some products that really engage the child have a timeless appeal. You ask anyone that ever played with it, they love their Meccano.
Meccano, you were there. You were involved. You were an engineer, even at the age of seven, making little things.
They are miniatures of real life, aren't they? And you've got your own world to set apart and have as you want it.
I'd build cranes, I'd lift things up, I'd build windmills. I even built my own pinball machine out of cardboard with flippers. I used bits of inner tube around there, like Meccano flippers.
Yeah, yeah.
And now it didn't spring, you just had to wind it. And I could play with steel ball bearings.
I still think of Meccano as the great toy of my lifetime, really.
These lovely surprise boxes used to arrive. My father used to bring them back from the factory. It was so fascinating, the way it was presented and boxed and so attractively painted.
Well, I've got here this box of Meccano, which I think is probably late 1940s, which I bought
in a closing down sale in a shop for 60p about 30 years ago. Every set of Meccano had a handbook of what you could do, what you could make with that set.
They originally called it Mechanics Made Easy, and then it was a bit of a long sentence, so they just thought up Meccano, and it seemed absolutely right, didn't it? It still does, actually.
Frank Hornby, who designed Meccano, is the most fascinating character.
I remember him very well, although I was only 7. He always smoked gorgeous Corona cigars, so you knew when he was around. He had a lovely waxed moustache, wore very nice suits, and had a silver-topped cane. He actually was, I suppose you call it, a great Victorian.
Frank Hornby was a businessman, a bit of an inventor. He was looking for something for his sons to play with, something new. And, of course, they would build things out of, you know, construction sets, but in those days they would have been made of, you know, stone bricks or, you know, possibly wooden bricks and things like that. He had this idea to use strips of metal, nuts and bolts, you know, you got your little screwdriver and spanner and things like that. He created these designs that could make all sorts of different things out of this core kit.
A Meccano unicyclist.
I think he was very interested in everything to do with windmills and natural energy and water mills and everything that worked naturally. And he thought that everything that was built was beautiful, and he wanted children to be able to reproduce them.
He believed passionately, and he was a man of his time, that boys should learn about mechanics and engineering.
One of Frank Hornby's ideas was that he wanted boys in particular to think about what they were doing and plan and follow quite a detailed plan.
Architects and engineers, you still hear them saying on the radio or on television, we built it first with a Meccano set. This painting is of Winston Churchill and his nephews helping him to build a Meccano set. Apparently Winston Churchill was going through a difficult time and needed something to perk him up, and it helped a lot.
It's made of acrylonitrile butadiene styrene. It's exactly 8mm by 9.6mm with a 5mm diameter raised circle. It is, of course, a Lego brick. And it's been that way since exactly 1:58pm on the 28th of January 1958. Any brick manufactured from that moment onwards will fit into a brand new Lego brick with the same satisfying... Isn't that lovely?
A heart made out of Lego bricks.
The plastic generation started after the Second World War. The introduction of durable plastic is a significant turning point in toy production. Everybody started making all sorts of toys. Toys that were produced cheaply, all sorts of different colours. You could make anything out of plastic. A Danish chap called Christensen thought this would be the thing to make bricks out of.
I was probably one of the first children in the country to get Lego, and it was all, in those days, red and white, either what we call eights or fours, like this.
One of the things about Lego, and it was designed this way, is, of course, that every piece of Lego can be used with every other piece of Lego that's ever invented.
It has such versatility. Essentially, it's a brick. But then from that brick, you can make what you like.
Great thing about it was you could build anything you wanted. It was a way of exploring your imagination, a way of creating another world.
What Lego have done so brilliantly, they found a way to evolve the core principle of a building brick in a range of other areas. They did a brilliant commercial which captured this. That commercial, for me, is, I think, the best toy commercial ever.
You see, I was standing outside my mouse hole the other day, when all of a sudden, along comes this cat. So quick as a flash, I turned into a dog. A ruff ruff. But the cat turned into a dragon. So I turn into a fire engine. As a... And then he turned into a submarine. So I became a submarine-eating kipper. I said a kipper, not a slipper. Thank you very much. But he turned into an anti-kipper ballistic missile. So I turned into a missile cruncher. Crunch, 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 crunch. Just in time to see him change into a very, very big elephant. So do you know what I did then? I turned back into a mouse and I gave him the threat of his life. Just like that.
The secret to the most timeless toys and the best toys is that actually they're not the end product. They allow you to play in different ways. So Meccano and Lego and Action Man and Barbie aren't really about what's produced by the manufacturer. They're about everything that's around it that's created by the person playing with it. Lego is just a brick, but then when you build it up, it becomes a fire engine, a monster, or a spaceship.
The thing about enduring toys, you can add to them and grow them, and it's what you invest in them. When you invest your imagination in them, that's what makes them endure.
Helen Jones, child of the 80s.
Remember gonks? No, neither does anyone else. Not every toy can be Meccano or Lego, still as popular now as the day it was launched. Some burn brightly for a year or two before crashing to earth in charity shops, car boot sales, and toy museums. These are the crazes. Whatever that year's craze was, if you didn't have one, you might as well have gone to school dressed as one of the Von Trapps. They were must-have items. Hula hoops, roller skates, dealy boppers, clackers, BMX bikes, and in 1987, four little turtles named after Italian Renaissance artists. Weird. Every year, the media would be full of horror stories about that year's craze. They were dangerous, antisocial, non-educational, but everybody knew what these stories really meant. They were brilliant.
Bouncing orange space hoppers.
Crazes come and go. I can't fathom out why. I built a whole troll village in the garden. They were just great. Grab it to
the east, grab it to the Deborah Meaden, businesswoman, entrepreneur, and dragon.
Cabbage patch dolls. You know, I mean, for goodness sake, what was all that about? But you had to have them because already in the States, every child had to have one. Well, of course, we've all got to have them.
It's caused angry scenes and injuries inside stores as customers join in buying stampedes.
What do we tell our little girl Christmas morning? What are we supposed to say? You've been good, but Santa ran short? Grab it tight, don't let
it go. They marketed it brilliantly. They'd have the little doll heads surrounded by a cabbage leaf, and to a kid, it looked like a child was growing in a field.
The strange round-headed dolls.
Toys being successful is all about the right time, the right place, the right moment, and the right mood. And sometimes a lovely toy can come out, but it just doesn't quite hook into the feeling of the moment. It can sit there for years, and then suddenly somebody will spot it again and say, "Wow, look at that, that's absolutely brilliant."
Children yo-yoing.
It's almost like they can sit there dormant for a while and then the world around them makes them relevant and suddenly everybody goes, oh, there it is again.
Remember the yo-yo? It certainly made a comeback at the Yo-Yo World Championships recently in Mexico City.
The yo-yo has a very long history. There are pictures of the yo-yo on ancient Greek vases, for instance. It actually becomes very popular in the sort of 18th century, in France in particular, in the aristocratic level of society, including royalty. And when, of course, a lot of people had to leave France during the French Revolution and came to England, they brought the yo-yo with them. It also found its way down to the Philippines, where a variant of it was used as a weapon. But people were also playing with it, and an American chap called Duncan saw this and he thought, that looks quite fun. So he actually brought it back to the States. The thing about the yo-yo in general, I think, is it's just such a simple toy. Basically, it's some wood and a string. It's very easy. I mean, you could even make your own.
Solve the cube.
It was the ultimate puzzle game.
I got so frustrated that I was one of those kids who peeled all the stickers off and then put them back on in the order that they should, you know, instead of trying to fiddle around with it and wasting my time doing this stupid thing.
Crazies like that, they have a certain uniqueness about them, and there's something that just catches the imagination.
Rubik's cubes being manufactured.
Now, just before going on the air this evening, I set Hugh Scully a problem tackled by millions of people every day with varying degrees of success.
I was given one of these puzzles for Christmas, and it's been driving me absolutely mad.
Brainchild of Hungarian Professor Erno Rubik is rapidly assuming the status of a world cult.
Rubik invented the cube to help his students at Budapest University to think in three dimensions.
It's a very basic form and a very basic problem.
I probably could still do it now if you gave it to me. I wasn't quick, but I learned how to do it because I wasn't going to be beaten by the thing.
25 seconds gone.
Think about how many hours of fun you have with a cube. Someone tossed a cube at you and said, work that out, mate. Days, weeks, you're sitting there going...
This book has been one of the publishing sensations of the year. It's called You Can Do the Cube and has just become an American bestseller, number one, in fact.
I thought it might just sell about 10,000 copies, but it's sold over a million, which came as a shock. One night I got a phone call and they said, congratulations.
Just when you're about to finally crack the Rubik's Cube, well, you've done half of one side. All right, nearly half. Two squares, then. Something terrible happens. You have to stop playing with your presents and eat lunch. Nothing wrong with that idea in principle. Shove a bit of fuel in the tank, keep you going for another 18 hours. But no, it's just not any lunch. It's the biggest lunch in the world.
Chefs bring a Christmas feast into a wood-panelled dining room. The family round the table applaud and the turkey is carved. Another family tucking in.
What is it all about? The average person eats 6,000 calories on Christmas Day. 3 days allocation of food in one day. What?
Christmas dinner. I mean, I must have been 3.5 stone in weight, but I just sat there until I couldn't move. I would eat everything.
Overcooked dry turkey, loads of roast potatoes, parsnips, cauliflower, cabbage, sausages in bacon, and loads of stuffing. Christmas pudding that nobody really likes. It's always the same. And then a great big hunk of bird carcass that you've got to pick at for the next 2 days. Nothing has changed at all.
People have always saved up their money for the best they could possibly get at Christmas. And certain foods become associated with that very early on, largely due to price. So if you were to look in a medieval kitchen at Christmas, they would be using the raisins, the dates, the figs, the spices, which we still use as Christmas food, all that sort of mince pie and Christmas pudding sort of flavours.
Mince pies are just a superb invention, probably one of the West's greatest inventions since the motor car. And because you've got light, buttery, flaky pastry and sweet mincemeat inside, what's not to like? And it's in a handy one-size mouthful, if you're so inclined, but at the most two or three. In fact, you can go in the kitchen, nick one, and no one will ever know.
My mother used to make everything herself. Christmas pudding, Christmas cake, and a thing peculiar in Scotland called a black bun.
I remember my mother doing absolutely everything, laying the table, doing all the preparation, and I'm afraid doing the clearing up with very little help.
We used to have a big joint of ham, this is really weird, for breakfast, and pickles. Then at lunch, we'd have the full Monty blowout. Lovely turkey, which my mum would always slightly overcook, because that's how we like our food, slightly overcooked.
My mother put the turkey on at 9 o'clock the night before. Can you believe that? What was she trying to do, make a pair of shoes?
Doing a Christmas lunch for many more people than you would normally cook for is really hard. You know, you try plating up 8, 10, 12, 14 dishes. You know, you're not caterers. You're people at home. You're not supposed to be able to do this. And it's stressful. And you want everybody to have a good time, but the person who's not having a good time is you. I mean, when I had my family coming around, I'd opened all the presents. I thought, right, give me a tin of Quality Street, stick some James Bond on, I want to lay on the sofa. No.
It's this mammoth cooking task. My mother's in the kitchen, along with my father, doing all these things, all these pots and pans are going, and then you sit down as a family and you have your Christmas dinner.
One Christmas, I remember my dad wanting everybody to sit around the same table. So what he did was he knocked down the wall that divided the living room and the dining room, and then put one huge table through the middle of the wall, you know, and so we could all sit together. And it was wonderful. It was one of the best Christmases that we had, you know, and then after Christmas, he bricked up the wall again.
The Christmas crackers.
Oh, yeah.
That was sometimes the best thing about Christmas dinner.
Yeah.
The hats were annoying. They were always too big for me, so I was eating my dinner and this paper hat was just slipping down my face, and I was at one point, you know, sticking a fork through a paper hat and then it doesn't work. Christmas
pudding, listen. Arlene Phillips, child of the 1950s. Christmas pudding
surely is the thing. Always a Christmas pudding with a sixpence inside that someone was going to get, and with three children there was always a fight who was going to get the sixpence.
Anybody at Christmas time going for a slice of cake and a cup of tea is a wuss. By tea time, you should be on the hard spirits.
As I've got older, I have got into all the things that you're supposed to like about Christmas. Long walks, furry jumpers, baked potatoes, small glasses of Abelur.
Asti spumanti.
Asti spumanti.
It was brilliant. I just go, would you like a little bit? So, oh, yes, please. Mm. And what was great, because there was always like little bits left. So I'd go, oh, I'll take, when we were clearing the table, I'd take the buzz, and on the way to the kitchen, I'd be like,
yeah.
It's just out of badness, really. It was great. Have a holly,
jolly Christmas. We did look forward to all these meals, and you were very, very stuffed at the end of the week because it stretched over to New Year's Day, and then, boom, the life became grey again. But for just that moment, just that week, it was very red and very rosy. Oh, by golly, have a holly, jolly
Christmas this year. Archive footage of a family sitting around having their Christmas dinner. A wind-up Santa toy.
Finally, 6 hours later, lunch is over. The survivors are carried out on makeshift stretchers and given emergency resus. For the children of Britain, it's time to gather round the TV and shout, I want one of those!
Television introduced different things to children that they wouldn't have seen if they didn't go in the shops. Sooty and muffin, they were marketed... For children. That's perhaps the first consumer thing I remember.
Muffin was from the early days of television, and there weren't that many programmes. Well, there weren't that many programmes full stop, but there weren't that many programmes for children on television. So when Muffin was on, then, you know, everybody, I mean, so the younger children really loved him. And, of course, then what happened, of course, is that they started producing toys. So, of course, you get the, you know, the character merchandise bit starting up. A company called Moco made the very, you know, very famous metal muffin puppet that children could then actually play with themselves.
Now, that's one thing I did want. I wanted this metal Muffin the Mule with the strings that made it dance, just like you would see on television. Television was a massive influence.
Muffin the Mule on a sleigh, wearing a Santa suit.
My goodness me, there's Father Christmas himself, with his red cloak and his white beard, riding on a sleigh. Oh, Muffin, of course, it's Muffin the Mule.
Jump. Muffin the Mule is probably the first star of children's television. He appeared in a programme along with Annette Mills, who was a singer, actress.
This is Muffin's Christmas party, you know. Muffin, I just liked it. Come along.
We all called her Annie. She was always the star of television, I suppose, to me. She was a sort of fairy tale character. Beautiful dresses, rustle of silk, gorgeous big collars and petticoats. She was around and about, but I was too tiny to really take notice. I remember a pretty lady sitting at the piano playing the tunes from the Muffin the Mule show, and her petticoats rustled.
We want Muffin, Muffin the Mule.
We want Muffin, Muffin the Mule. Dear old Muffin.
There was none of this sort of hide the strings and pretend that that's... You know, she sat there on the chair and the strings went down and Muffin would go clickety-clickety-clacking along.
Muffin, Muffin.
I've got an attic full of fan letters from people who asked Muffin to solve their problems and who absolutely loved him and wondered what he got up to when he wasn't dancing on the piano.
This television star was made of 3-ply wood and felt, and through him, Annette Mills reached the hearts of countless children and grown-ups.
The advent of television changed absolutely everything because it was the beginning of the consumer age.
Television made toys much more glamorous than they actually were because it built a story very professionally around the toy. It made the thing itself much more exciting.
You all had to have the Steve Austin $6 million man doll, which you looked through his eye. And he had an arm. You pressed his back. And because he was strong, he would do that and lift it up. And that was the height of cool. You know, we all had to have one of those.
It was getting a toy of something that was a cartoon series, for example, like Transformers. You saw them as cartoons, so to actually be able to physically touch and handle these things was great.
Wait, Dad's saying something. He's had what? An idea. Oh, this always ends badly. And today he's had his Christmas idea. He wants to go for a walk. No! After an hour or so of this foolishness, Dad is satisfied and you're allowed back indoors. Once your hands have thawed, you can play with some of the things that come in boxes.
A jazz trumpet player. Richard Allen, son of Lois Allen, creator of Fuzzy Felt.
My mother was brought up during the Roaring Twenties in the States. She still danced the Charleston till the day she died. She smoked when women just didn't smoke. She was a game gal. Her parents sent her over to Paris to study art. She ended up as a graphic designer, and that stood her in good stead in designing Fuzzy Felt. My parents came back to live in Farnham Common, where my parents bought a house. My father went off to war, and my mother was left with a large garden that had a lot of outbuildings in it, and she decided to do something for the war effort. She approached Cooper's Mechanical Joints in Slough and started making gaskets. She employed the local women to come in and help her. The women, by and large, had young children, so my mother set up a creche. My mother found out that cut felt shapes stuck to the back of a table mat would keep the children amused, and out came Fuzzy Felt.
I grew up in the 40s and 50s, and I think toys that took a long time to create were really important because there was a lot of time to fill because you didn't have a lot of things.
My mother designed everything, all the way down to doing the lettering and everything else, and was very, very particular in having things absolutely just right. She wouldn't bring a product to market unless she was happy that the child could make a really good number of pictures without running out of ideas.
I love toys where you could build from nothing into something. On a plain board, you could build a garden full of colour. And then you could actually build a little girl or a little boy.
We had the most magical working relationship. I ran the factory, she did the designing. I had to call her by her Christian name from an early age because at trade shows you can't really say, "Mummy, what do you think of this?" So I called her by her name, Lois. The only time I really used the word mummy was at Christmas on a present or something.
Spirograph was the hallucinogenics for the under-10s. While our parents were getting battered on sherry and port, we were lying on the floor getting high as kites, making these endless swirly patterns, round and 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 round.
Grievous Fisher, son of Dennis Fisher, creator of Spirograph.
Spirograph was an invention by my father that enabled children to draw patterns that had a wonderful symmetry, texture and colour. very simply, just by using a pen and a cog round a wheel.
At first, you just do a pattern, but then you realise you can go outside the big circle, then you can build up matrices of stuff.
You could just make thousands and thousands of different types of patterns. So I'd spend hours and hours and hours doing these, and then I'd plaster them all over the walls.
Perhaps this new toy is one of the few completely original toys of the century. It was designed by an engineer, not a toy manufacturer. With these wheels, a child may teach himself more economically the real meaning of mathematical relationships. These patterns can give an insight into the orbits of space capsules or satellites.
In the 1960s, there were so many different things going on. All the boundaries seeming to be coming down, politically, economically, or whatever. In effect, if you had an idea, you could run with it.
Dennis Fisher studied the design of a pound note. He thought its intricate patterns were made by a simple gearing mechanism. There and then, he decided to make a pattern-drawing toy based on that principle. His problem, how to translate algebraic formulae into shapes.
My father had always been fascinated throughout his life with mathematics. He enjoyed the magic of numbers. Music was an integral element within his creative process. He was very knowledgeable about engineering and plastics, so he was involved in, you know, the first prototype. Then he had to obviously go out and sell the idea. Everything was staked on it. His Rolly camera was sold. My mother sold her jewellery. His dark room was dismantled and that equipment was sold off. My first job ever was at the age of 15 to demonstrate Spirograph, Christmas 1965, at Matthias Robinson department store in Leeds. I wasn't too far away from Santa's grotto. I had a table and I'd be busy drawing away and so on, and feeling alternately chuffed with what I was achieving and a bit embarrassed if the pattern didn't quite go exactly as I'd wanted. A lot of children over the world have had a great deal of pleasure from using Spirograph. For some of them, it may have been a springboard to develop an artistic career or a mathematical career or maybe an engineering career. I brought down the first production set ever that was made of Spirograph, and on the back of it there's a little message I'd like to read, if I may. And it says, "The first set to be presented in the world to my very dearest wife, fellow director and friend Betty, Dennis, 1964, Christmas morning."
Spinning Spirograph shapes.
If you're lucky, Santa's brought you a new board game. Oh, look at it. A promise of hours of laughter, thrills and entertainment. You unfold the board, get all the little pieces out of their plastic bags, shuffle the cards, and then there it is. The rule book. It lands with an audible thud, and you feel the icy hand of reality gripping your shoulder. Maybe it's in 16 languages. Just English. This is going to be about as much light-hearted fun as trying to land a 747 on one engine on a motorway in thick fog. But you're not going to back down now, not in front of the whole family. You're going to enjoy the next 5 hours if it kills you. Right, roll a double six to start. What kind of sadistic mind made that the very first rule? Damn you, Waddingtons! 40 minutes later, someone rolls a double six. And we're off.
Mark Connolly, historian, University of Kent.
Parlour games are really good at emphasising two things: family togetherness, but at the same time, you know, that's slightly what we might think of kind of a safe way of letting out dangerous passions, that the youngest can be more powerful than the eldest.
Christmas particularly was spent playing board games. And we actually didn't have a television for a long, long time. So it was bring out the games.
Lots of laughter, lots of buzziness, and maybe lots of fights as well.
Children play Monopoly.
I always played to win. If I thought I wasn't going to win, I could turn into the most negative of players. I'm ashamed of myself. Arlene, You're a bad board game player.
For most of us, it's an escape into a dream world of property deals, big business, and takeover bids. The most popular board game in the world, Monopoly.
Money's counted out and pieces are moved.
Monopoly, to me, was the big time. I'd never been to Bond Street. I didn't know where Mayfair was. I knew Fleet Street was where they printed newspapers. For me, it was like a big adventure.
Monopoly's actually a really sort of geeky, odd thing for children to like, and they can't possibly understand it. And I realise now that I used to play it without understanding any of it, and annuity matures and things like that on the chance cards. Money!
You know, at the start of the game, you get a certain amount of money, which obviously I didn't have when I was a kid, so I had money in my hand. I could choose to buy what I wanted to. I had choice. I had freedom. I was a businessman.
The game continues.
I took it so seriously. The worst thing you could ever say to me is, oh, I give up. No, I wanted you out of your house.
The history of Monopoly goes back to the early 20th century. It's based on a game called The Landlord's Game, which was conceived by a lady called Lizzie McGee, who was a Quaker. At that time in America, there was a movement to create a new tax for landowners because it was seen that a lot of people who rented land were losing out and the landowners were just getting rich and fat. Charles Darrow, who was the man credited with inventing Monopoly, came across a version of this game and created his own version. And his board used the streets in Atlantic City, which is where he used to go on holiday. Monopoly now, you know, he who wins everything wins the game. And yes, that wasn't the original idea at all.
We bought a new Monopoly set last Christmas, but it was one of those where there's no money anymore. You get like a card, a credit card, and the banker has a card reader. And he swipes your card, your passcode, collect £200. Does he? Yeah, we've got it at home. It's
really?
It's exactly the same, but it has moved with the times a little bit.
The amount shows 14 million.
Oh! It's nearly over. Tomorrow is Boxing Day, the worst day of the year. 364 days till Christmas. Let's finish with some excitement. Go out with a bang. The Gilbert U-238 Atomic Energy Lab. The one with the little samples of actual uranium in it. Yeah, let's play with that. You just fire up the reactor and hope for the best. If all that seems a bit brutal, maybe you just need something to cuddle. In Victorian Britain, cuddling was simply not done. Anyone caught having a cuddle would immediately be transported to Australia on the orders of Queen Victoria. But as soon as the old misery died in 1901, cuddling came out of the closet. We weren't quite ready to cuddle each other. That sort of thing didn't happen until the 60s. So we turned for the answer to the cuddliest nation on earth, Germany. The first teddy bear was made by Steiff and named after President Teddy Roosevelt, who had refused to shoot one on a hunting trip. History does not record whether or not he cuddled it. But cuddling was on, and a whole new world of toys was born.
An old tatty teddy.
Post-war, when things were hard to come by, people made do, and these toys, this was mine and this was my brother Peter's, were made actually from a raincoat, the same raincoat. The elephant was made out of the outside, the gabardine part, and my teddy was made from the lining, put together, especially for me. He's unique, and I wouldn't have another teddy with lots of fur or anything. I think he's perfect, absolutely perfect.
In a factory, a teddy bear's fur shape is cut out and sewn, then stuffed on a machine. The hole where the stuffing rod went in is stitched, then a finished teddy bear sat up on his bottom and brushed down. Red ribbons are tied around their necks and they're put in plastic bags.
The teddy bear as a toy was first produced in Germany, the sort of famous Steiff company, which was started by Margaret Steiff in the 19th century. But it wasn't called a teddy bear at that time.
1904, Theodore Roosevelt, the President of the United States, went out shooting for bears.
The story goes that Roosevelt, of course, he was known as Teddy, couldn't find any bears, and so some people captured a little bear cub and brought it to him and said, here's a bear cub, you know, here it is, you can shoot it. But of course, he looked at it and he said, I'm not going to shoot that. This little bear cub then was featured in a cartoon, and from then on, it became associated with Teddy Roosevelt.
At that stage, there was a toy buyer from one of the big stores in New York who went to the Leipzig Fair in Germany, which was the big toy fair, and on the Stive stand was a bear, a soft toy bear. He bought 500.
Then the association between the soft toy bear and the real bear and the name Teddy came about, and so gradually people started calling it Teddy Bear. The teddy bear has definitely become one of the most popular and iconic toys of childhood. There's that love, that it's sort of instant love of something soft and cuddly. You could hug it and it became your friend.
This is Robert, or Bob the Bear, we used to call him. And look at him, he's patched up, he's really solid, he's not cosy at all, but being a lonely kid, I used to have a mate, and he was my mate. I did have a bit of a collection, but there was always one bear that was slightly more in my favour. We used to have arguments. Oh, yeah. He was quite an aggressive little bear. But anyway, we're friends now.
Finally, you've hit the wall. It's bedtime. Naturally, you take your absolutely favourite toy of the day to bed with you. You might wake up on Boxing Day cuddling your fluffy new teddy, or you might have your Transformers Dark of the Moon Voyager Megatron imprinted on your face till lunchtime. It doesn't matter, because when it comes to toys, it's up to you. There are no rules. Forget the instructions. The only limits are your imagination, your attention span, and the stress-resistant properties of polyvinyl chloride. A great toy can be made of anything. Plastic, wood, cardboard, metal, uranium. All right, maybe not uranium. When you're a kid, it doesn't matter, because toys aren't just inanimate objects. The minute you stop playing with them, they cease to exist. But get your Action Man or your fuzzy felt or your Lego out of the box, and time stands still. The grown-up world of rules and responsibilities holds its breath. Toys are who we were before all that stuff got into our heads and diluted the vivid joy of just being alive. It's still there, though, somewhere in a cupboard at the back of your memory. It never goes away. That moment when you open the present, and yes, you got it. It's yours forever. Enjoy it.
Mingled with old family footage of people unwrapping presents at home, the guest speakers also open presents.
Oh my God.
Wow!
Mary Quant.
Where did you find one?
Here comes Santa Claus.
60th anniversary of Fuzzy Felt. Almost the same age as me.
I have really never had one in my whole life. Look, she's even got a little special extra hair clip.
You've given me, at the age of 45, my first ever remote-controlled sports car.
That does honestly make my Christmas.
Here comes Santa Claus.
Here comes Santa Claus.
Right down Santa Claus Lane.
He doesn't care if you're rich or poor.
For he loves you just the same.
Santa knows that we're God's children.
That makes everything right.
Fill your hearts with a Christmas cheer.
'Cause Santa Claus comes tonight.
Christmas cheer, 'cause
Santa Claus comes tonight.